They said it ended in November 1916, that Battle of the Somme. Those history books that I've always read, they said it ended in the mud, the snow and the fog around Beaumont Hamel and the slopes above the River Onc. But did it really end then? Was it really all over, the Battle of the Somme? Did both sides dig in and tolerate each other's existence in the coldest winter in living memory? Did they really spend more time fighting the cold than each other? No. The answer is definitely no. The fighting went on, the killing went on. The enemy had to be harassed and killed. Trench raids went on. The fighting spirit had to be maintained, of course it did. There was definitely going to be no Christmas truce on the Somme in that winter of 1916. But that's not all. On the 17th of February 1917, 9,000 men from three divisions attacked the German lines in what's become known as the Battle of Boom Ravine. Not officially considered part of the Battle of the Somme, but it took place on the Somme, didn't it? Men died on the Somme, they're buried on the Somme, they're still missing on the Somme as a result of that battle near Courcelette, Boom Ravine. Boom Ravine was a natural feature where the high ground would give the BEF an advantage looking across the Ancre Valley. It looks exactly the same today as it did then. You walk from Courcelette down that country lane and eventually you reach the Regina Trench Cemetery. And from there you drop down into a valley where so many men died, and then you come up the other side and eventually you reach the Boom Ravine. Of those 9,000 men that went into action that day on the 17th of February 1917, there were over 2,000 casualties and there was limited success. They achieved some of their objectives, but not all. But so many things went wrong that day. There'd been several weeks of hard frost, and that suddenly gave way to a thaw. The artillery barrage that had been put together assumed that the infantry would be attacking over hard frozen ground. It was impossible to dig any assembly trenches because of the hard ground. Now, I live in Northampton. The 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment were there that day. They attacked. They were part of the 18th Division. They'd done really well during the main part of the Battle of the Somme, during the summer and autumn. They'd taken Trones Wood. They'd taken that German bastion, the fortress that was Teepvale, not far from where they were now. So many men from the county town of Northampton fell that day. And it's the story of Boom Ravine, and in particular, that 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires. It's their story that I wanted to tell in this episode of a podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. Now, I mentioned just now that quite a few things went wrong that day. Obviously, the change in the weather was probably the worst thing. But just before the North Ants and the other men went over the top, the Germans landed an artillery barrage right on their positions where they were forming up in the open. And if you look in the history of the 18th Division, there's a few lines that tells us the real reason, the uncomfortable truth of why so many men died that day. And it simply says this in a few lines. British treachery. Two men of a neighbouring division went over to the enemy and revealed the hour of the offensive, with the consequence that our attacking infantry were cut up by shellfire as they assembled in the dark in exposed positions. What an awful thought that is, the thought that for whatever reason, they haven't been captured, these men, by Germans. They've decided themselves to crawl out of the British trenches, to go across no man's land, not only to give themselves up to the enemy, but to tell the enemy where and when the British attack at Boom Ravine was about to start. I wonder who those men were. We don't know, we'll never know. I suppose with the passing of time, there's a possibility that that didn't happen, but it is reported in lots of the historic documents that I've looked at, both primary and secondary references in books. So it would seem likely that they were betrayed on that cold February morning as they formed up in the open. So we're going to look at some of the individual stories as we always do on this podcast, but I think it would be a good idea just to get an idea of what it was like to be on the Somme during that winter of 1916 going into 1917. And I believe that the frost and the snow had come 4 or 5 weeks before the 17th of February. And a historian that we've mentioned a few times, Richard Van Emden, he's written a book which he called The Somme, and it's the epic battle in the soldiers' own words and photographs. If you get a chance to get this book, I really would recommend it. I've spoken to Richard about this at a function, and he said that I think he got about 6,000 photographs that the soldiers themselves had taken, and at various times in Richard's military history career, he'd acquired these photos, and he's put a selection of them in this book. And he quotes a Corporal William Dawson from the heavy branch of the Machine Gun Corps, and he described the conditions on the Somme in that winter of 1916-17 as this. He says, "We were billeted in farm buildings, sleeping arrangements being wood frames with wire netting stretched across. These were very cold for sleeping on, especially as we were now experiencing severe frost and snow. As I had only one blanket, I took a favourable opportunity to acquire a bread bag and some straw, which made a fine mattress and stopped the cold underneath. Coming from Boston in Lincolnshire, I'd experienced plenty of very cold winters, but never anything so bad as the one we were now up against. Everything became frozen up, and water had to be obtained by melting ice and snow. Everything was frozen, particularly solid, including tins of fruit. Eggs obtained from nearby farms burst their shells, and one's boots were frozen stiff by the morning. This period of extreme cold lasted throughout January and most of February. Road transport for the greater part of this time was at a standstill, except for a minimum of light vehicles. I somehow managed to get some sleep through this very hard period with only my blanket and the loan of another leather jerkin from my friend Corporal Kennedy, who had two blankets. I need hardly say that the rum ration during this period was a real boon and blessing." Now, in front of me, I've got an unpublished book which was written by a man called Peter Jackson, and it's called The Glorious Sixth, meaning the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. And he compiled this book, it's like an exercise book, in 1975. And he said he compiled it on behalf of the surviving members of the battalion when they got together for one of their reunions, probably one of their final reunions in that year. And he goes into detail about what happened during the Battle of Boom Ravine. He said, "On the 16th of February, final preparations were made for a full-scale attack on the German positions to commence on the morrow. This operation would include attacks on both sides of the Onc in an effort to gain the high ground overlooking the valley. The task of the 6th was to launch an assault in front of Desire Trench, first cross Grand Corps Trench, then cross the sunken road that is known as Boom Ravine, to a point due north towards the South Miremont Trench. Forming up positions were marked out for 12 midnight, and the first of the four companies of the 6 had by 1 a.m. taken up their position. By 5 a.m. on the 17th, the other three companies of the 6 had taken up position and the operation was complete. Now, therefore, that tells us that for 4 hours, those men from the Northamptonshires, the 6 Northamptonshires, had been in their positions. And don't forget, they weren't in trenches. They were out in the open. It was freezing cold. But, of course, the thaw had set in by this time. He goes on to say, by 5 a.m, the assaulting battalions consisted of the 6th North Ants on the right and the 11th Royal Fusiliers on the left, with the Middlesex in support and the Bedfordshires in reserve. During the night, the weather broke, and under a steady rain, the hard frosted roads on which we had banked so much now began to assemble a sandy beach after the tide had gone out, and for the men were now wading knee-deep in mud. The forming up positions were situated in front of a depression known as the Gully, and in turn a sunken road ran from the Gully into Boom Ravine itself. The tapes denoted the forming up positions being some 100 to 200 yards in front of the Gully. About an hour before zero, which was set for 5:45, the enemy opened up an intense barrage on both the Gully and the forming up lines, resulting in heavy losses amongst the two assaulting positions battalions. One platoon of the 6th was almost entirely wiped out. Punctually at 5:45 a.m, our own barrage opened up, and the assaulting battalion of the 6th followed in close proximity. On arrival at Grandcourt Trench, much of the enemy wire was found to be uncut. This resulted not only in delay whilst the forward troops sought gaps, but in turn gave the Germans time to get away and take up new positions each side of the Boom Ravine. Soon after 6:30 a.m, the right company advanced from the ravine, but the mud had slowed down their rate of advance to such an extent that they completely lost the barrage. And this is the creeping barrage that they're talking about, which is landing on the German positions, sort of 100 yards in front of them. And the idea is that they stay close behind the barrage so that the enemy hasn't got time to raise their heads and set up their machine guns. That's the idea anyway. But they're being held up by the terrible conditions. So he goes on. This meant as they approached South Miremont Trench without support of any kind, they found themselves in an insidious position of confronting an enemy trench with themselves knee-deep in mud, the wire uncut, and the enemy lining the trench. Under the adjutants, Lieutenant T.R. Price, a few of the 6 did manage to get a foothold in the trench, but with the whole of the line now held up, there was little hope of hanging on. They accordingly withdrew and dropped into the nearest shell holes. Around 8:30 a.m, the Germans counterattacked from the direction of Petit Miremont with specifically trained counterattack troops. From captured German officers, we learnt that the enemy had been aware of the whole operation and that these troops had been requested the night previously. Finding further movement now out of the question, the assaulting company of the 6th now fell back in order to form a defensive flank along the West Miremont Road. During this action, Lieutenant Colonel Medrick was killed shortly after leaving the ravine. The line as it stood, strengthened by remnants from other battalions, was now held until the afternoon. And on the next evening, these hard-won series of posts were handed over to the 8th Battalion of the East Surrey Regiment, and the 6th Battalion returned to billets in Marlborough Huts. So once again, in that unpublished account, there's a reference to the Germans being fully aware of the British plan, and of course the story being given away by the deserters that we mentioned earlier. Now, one of the few reporters to be given permission to follow the battle was a man called Philip Gibbs, and he wrote a book called From Bapaume to Passchendaele, 1917, and he describes what he saw at the Battle of Boom Ravine. He says, in difficulty, in grim human courage, in all its drama of fog and darkness and shellfire and death, it seems to me to hold most of what the war means to individual men, all that can be asked of them in such hours. He says, the thaw had just set in and the ground was soppy, which was bad luck. In spite of the thaw, it was horribly, damply cold. But the men had been given a good meal before forming up for the attack, and the officers brought up the rum ration in bottles so the men could attack with some warmth in them. In the utter darkness, unable to make any glimmer of light lest the enemy should see, the brigades tried to get into line. Two companies lost themselves and they were lost, but got into touch again in time. It was black and beastly. A great fire of high explosives burst over our assembly lines. The darkness was lit up by the red flashes of these bursting shells. Men fell wounded and dead. There is a sunken road almost parallel with Grandcourt Trench and with the South Miremont Trench beyond. Before war came, even last summer indeed, it was like a Devonshire lane, with steep shelving banks 30 to 40 feet high and trees growing on either side with overhanging roots. It was not like a Devonshire lane when our men scrambled and fell down its banks. It was a ravine of death. Our shellfire had smashed down all the trees, and their tall trunks lay at the bottom of the gully and their branches were flung about. The banks had been opened by shell craters, and several of the German dugouts built into the sides of them were upheaved or choked. Dead bodies or human fragments lay among the branches and broken woodwork. A shell of ours had entered one dugout and blown 6 men out of its doorway. They sprawled there at the entrance. Inside were 6 other dead. From dugouts not blown up or choked came groups of German soldiers, pallid and nerve-broken, who gave themselves up quickly enough. One man was talkative. He said in perfect English that he'd been a coachman to an English earl, and he cursed our artillery, and said that if he could get back at the blinking gunners, he'd wring their blighted necks, or words to that effect. I wonder what he did actually say. Gibbs then goes on to talk about something else that went wrong as the leading British units passed over the German front line. They saw, or they thought they saw, many German dead. But this, in fact, was a ruse, and gives us evidence of this. While Boone Ravine was being cleared of its livid inhabitants by the Royal Fusiliers, other ways were coming up, or rather not ways, but odd groups of men, dodging over the shell craters and hunting as they went for German snipers, who lay in their holes firing until they were pinned by bayonet points. Their bodies lie there now, curled up. Some of them pretended to be dead when our men came near. One of them lay still, with his face in the moist earth. "See, that man is properly dead," said an officer, and a soldier pricked the man. He sprang up with a scream and ran hard away to our lines. Six prisoners came trudging back from the ravine with a slightly wounded man as an escort. On the way back, they found themselves very lonely with him, and they passed some rifles in their way. They seized their rifles and became fighting men again, until a very little Welsh officer at the South Wales borders met them, and he killed every one of them with a revolver. Some of the men were walking like old men because of their tiredness. They looked pinched and worn, but they did splendidly, said one of their brigadiers. They were put to the highest test. They were indeed, but some of the young officers who went through and beyond Boone Ravine and had the luck to come back again described their adventures as they were but a nightmare from which they awakened laughing. One especially young adjutant, one of those clean-shaven, grey-eyed boys whose youth startles middle age because they are such veterans of war, had a whimsical way of hiding his own gallantry, because if he had not hidden it, he'd have had to admit that he was what the picture papers call a hero, and he would rather bite his tongue out. Then there was a doctor whom I met after Tietvau. He sang the song of his stretcher bearers, and it was good to hear. Well, this was the crowd who were in the Battle of Boone Ravine last Saturday morning. So that gives you an overall account of what happened in Boone Ravine on that day. And I had a quick look at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website and found that just alone within the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires, 111 men died on that day, and no doubt many more died of their wounds in the days that followed. And of those 111 that died, 48 of them are buried in the Regina Trench Cemetery, which overlooks the battlefield. And there's another 61 soldiers that fell that day have no known grave. They're remembered on the Tietvau Memorial to the Missing, and no doubt some of those are buried in Regina Trench Cemetery, but buried under a headstone that says, "Known unto God." So now what I'd like to do is look at what happened that day, the 17th of February 1917, through the eyes of the men that were actually there. And the reason that I chose to look at the Battle of Boone Ravine now is because it's mid-February, or it will be mid-February probably by the time you're listening to this, and that will mean it's very close, or maybe even on the anniversary itself, which will now be, 106 years since those men went into action in that terribly cold, damp and horrible landscape. And so many of them are still there. But the survivors, through their own eyes, using their own voices, tell us what happened. And the first one, I managed to find an actual recording. We can actually hear the voice of one of those men that was there himself. And his name was Private Horace Ham. And he was with the 12th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment. They were serving alongside the Northamptonshires on that day. And Horace had been slightly wounded himself on the first day of the battle, the 1st of July 1916. But he was back in the lines for this attack at Boone Ravine, and he takes up the story himself. And he begins by telling us what it was like on the Somme the year before the main battle of the Somme, and also that hard winter of 1916-17.
And there I went to the 12th Middlesex up in Elbert. That's on the Somme, I was on the Somme actually 2 years.
How do you feel going out again?
Oh, not much. Not very good. We didn't. You could. Oh, you had to go. I mean, anybody who tells me they were. I've heard people say, oh, I'm not windy. I reckon everybody had fear of being killed. But you didn't know when the shot was going to pitch on you. Anyhow, put that aside. That's only a detail. But we were there again, and I joined the 12th Battalion of Middlesex at Elbert.
What was the situation there?
Oh, well, Elbert was a town. The people that were living there, and they were there at Elbert. I don't know if you ever heard of the tale of the Leaning Virgin. Well, I stood under there many times. It was on a church. A German shell knocked the Virgin very upright and knocked her sideways. And the French engineers went up and wired her up so she couldn't fall. And the story was that when that fell, the war would end, but it didn't. Anyhow, we was in Elbert in the neck for a month or so, going up to the line. And we used to go up there.
Was there much activity at this time?
The first winter we were there, the 15-16 winter, we were flooded out with water in the trenches. And 16-17 winter, we were frozen out. Absolutely frozen stiff. And we were frozen as hard as you could get it. The ground was so hard, a German shell would come over, small ones, hit the ground and go up in the air again. Wouldn't go in the ground. But I'm jumping the gun a bit now. We used to go up from Elbert and take on parts of the line. One place we went, there was no front line when we got up there. Reserve trenches, but no front line. There was a lot of outposts. You know what an outpost is? About 50 yards apart they were. That was the front line when we were in the water there. Our platoon was in there. Next one along, all right. And it was very cold. My God, it was cold. Everything was frozen hard. We used to come out at night and walk around on the top and go back and get rations and that sort of thing. One night it was very dark, about 12 o'clock. We were a heck of a row going on, shouting, hollering, shooting, and the next one to us. What the devil's going on? You couldn't see nothing. You couldn't do nothing. We'd stay there. Well, next morning, our sergeant, I think it was, went along to see what had happened. And you know what had happened? A German patrol had come down between us and them. Between the two outposts, come down, go around the back up, and took them all away prisoner. Took them all prisoner. And then we said,
do you remember any other incidents?
Yes, well, I remember a lot. And sometime after that, our brigade took a trench called Regina Trench, a big one held by the Germans. And our brigade took it off. We were in it. And when we took it over, we had the front line. And the front line was up to there on me in mud and water. That was a front line mine. And we had to stay in it. The mud and water was so bad, I was the biggest chap in our section, being 6'1", that I used to have to go along and struggle through the mud and water to the headquarters to get the rations. The Battle of Boom Ravine. We advanced on Boom Ravine. We took the ravine. That's where I was in the second line of advance. We took the ravine, and there was a lot of Germans there too. After a fight, the first line got them in. And we got in that ravine, and just before we got there, now what I'm going to tell you now is gospel truth. It's God's truth. There was another trench. There was two or three Germans in there, and they were lying on the side moaning. So there was one or two of our fellows there. So we said, what the hell's happened here? Well, they said, these bastards, let our first line go through, and then we're shooting them in the back from there. And we caught them at it, so we killed them straight away. They bashed their heads in. And then we went on from there, and we took... Then when we got over the top of there, the Germans retreated. They went. We had no opposition at all. We got to a place called Achilles-le-Grand, which is well known in the last war. Achilles-le-Grand, Billancourt, and Achilles-le-Petit. And we stopped it on the road. And there was a big chateau, all ablaze, where the Germans had set a fire, and they'd gone. But all across the road, they put a lot of trees for the transport coming up, so they soon cleared that. I was in the machine gun section, I was number two on the gun. And we went up in between the two villages over a big field. The villages were quite close together there. And there was a little trench in there. No shells, nothing, there'd been no fight in there. So we followed up in this trench, our section, and up at the top, about 400 yards up, there was a little redoubt made. So we went in there and we settled down in there. We hadn't been there about an hour. The only time I ever saw German mounted cavalry, a German patrol come up over a ridge about 600 yards from us, German Uhlans, which is the same as our Lancers. And our sergeant, if he had waited, he got the lot. He said, "Oh, he's open fire." And the chap opened fire on the machine gun. He got one of them. The other surrounded and disappeared down over a ridge on the horses.
What did you have to do in the gun crew?
I had to load the gun. I had to keep loading it. I'll tell you all about that in a minute. Well, we've been up there about a couple of hours. Up come a runner. "You've gone too far. You're much more advanced than any other troops. You've got to come back and join the others." We'd gone too far. The others were all behind us. We left them. We'd gone too far. So we went back down this little trench, and being number two on a Lewis gun, you had to carry two panniers about that size in your valise on the back to reload your gun. Well, we were going back down this trench, it's only about that deep, and a German machine gun opened up on us. We ducked down and we run along, and my valise must have been showing over the top. He peppered that. He smashed those two magazines, smashed them. We couldn't use them anymore. Smashed that, and my billy can, and my valise tore. Never touched me. That's why I was lucky.
Could you feel it when you...
Yeah, I could feel it. It hit me in the back. But didn't know what it was. It didn't touch me. And when we got back to the road, it was all over. They'd gone, the Germans had gone, man. And we stood on that road, it actually had gone. That night, we stood on that road and we counted seven fires burning. Well, as you know, in France, practically every big village has a chateau. What the Germans were doing, as they retreated, they were setting fire to these chateaus, and we counted seven. And we were on the side of the road in a bit of a hole. It's got dark. We were laying there, apparently, a big black face come up over the side. Whoa, it made us jump. It was a Bengal Lancer. He'd been wounded, and he crawled in. I remember that quite well.
Now, there are many incredible aspects of that interview that was carried out with the Imperial War Museum, I think, in the 1960s. And as you can tell from his voice, by this time, Horace was a very old man, but with a crystal clear memory of what happened, not just on the 17th of February, but throughout his stay on the Somme in 1915, 16 and 17. But probably, as he said there, him and his unit of Lewis gunners had gone way beyond everybody else. Everybody else had been caught in the German stormtroopers' counter-offensive and had been pushed back across the battlefield, almost to the positions where they started from. But somehow, Horace and his mates had got way ahead of everybody else, and they didn't realise, and it was a wonder they weren't completely surrounded and either cleaned out or taken prisoner. But as he said, he lived to tell the tale, and he lived to tell the story to us on this podcast. At the end of the interview there, he was talking about seeing fires burning and Germans retreating, and this was the start of the great German retreat to the Hindenburg Line that took place shortly after the battle. So, you know, there they were, 2,000 casualties that we said from the three divisions that went into attack on that day. And the chances are, well, it's true, it's not even guesswork really, that those lives really were given up for nothing, because within a couple of weeks, the Germans had given up all the ground that they'd fought so hard to take from them. and had withdrawn, what, 15, 20 miles to the Hindenburg line, smashing everything in their way, blocking all the roads, poisoning the wells, cutting down all the trees, burning and destroying anything that would be of any value to the Allies as they gave up that ground. And it must have been a horrible feeling to the families of those men that died, knowing that they really did die in vain. In hindsight, of course, they didn't know that when they went into action. They didn't know that the Germans were going to withdraw. It was one of those big secrets. So we've heard so far about some of the terrible things that happened in that battle, with the Germans playing dead and the British killing them, clubbing them to death. But let's look at a complete contrast to that story. A story that I found in a local newspaper, and it's entitled Friendship After the Somme. The subtitle says German Lives Saved, an Invitation to His Rescuer. And I'll read the article to you. Going out under heavy shellfire into the Boom Ravine at the mouth of Death Valley on the Somme in February 1917, an English stretcher party discovered a young wounded German student who'd been lying helpless for 2 days. With the position of the stretcher party growing more perilous every moment, the question of finish him off, the German, was raised. But Mr. L. M. Baldwin from Leamington Spa persuaded his companions to take the wounded man back to the dressing station. Robert Liebig, the German, realised that Mr. Baldwin had saved his life and managed to speak to him on the way to the station. Now, 20 years after this remarkable meeting, the two men are to see each other again in Germany this summer as a result of an invitation by the German. He has asked his English friend to spend a holiday in Berlin. In a letter, Robert described his memories of the ordeal. And this letter, of course, is written in 1937, just 2 years before the start of the Second World War. But this is what he wrote to Mr. Baldwin in his letter. He said, "I remember the 19th of February pretty often. I remember, too, the row that was going on between you and some of your companions about finishing me off. I understood enough of your language to know what was going on. To be true, I had not a very peaceful feeling against one of your companions, especially as I'd brought back one of your chaps with what was left of my comrades just 3 days before. They'd both been on patrol duty during the night and were wounded by the same shell." Now, the article goes on to say that after recovering from his wounds in England, he went to Dartford Hospital. Liebig, or Robert, we'll call him, it's easier to pronounce, made a desperate attempt to get back to his native land. He actually escaped from a Staffordshire prisoner of war camp, and he got as far as Ipswich before he was captured again. He says in his letter that he was repatriated in November 1919 and he finished his studies. He went on to be a doctor. He said his father lost all his money in the crash, the German economy crash between 1920 and 1923. And he says, "So the fight for existence began. Now I'm an employee of a big limited company. It is not a bad position, though not the thing I dreamed of. But when the world's trade is down to the bottom, you get to be satisfied in time if you find an existence to keep your wife and yourself just on the sunny side of life after many years, which have been anything but sunny." And he finished off his letter. He said, "I was just 20 when I was wounded. I finished my studies and I got my degree and I intended to join the colonial administration. But when I finished there, there were no colonies left." I then found another report which actually gives us an idea of what happened when these two men did meet in Germany. It said, "A few days ago, two men, a German and an Englishman, clasped hands in Berlin over 20 years after they'd met in remarkable circumstances in the Boom Ravine. Mr. Baldwin stayed at Dr. Liebig's flat, which is situated in a suburb of Berlin, and was accompanied by a friend and Leamington man, a Mr. J. Smithson. The two Englishmen were feted everywhere as Englanders and have now returned with unforgettable memories of their holiday. Mr. Baldwin described his German friend's flat and the estate around it as typical of the well-planned and spacious scale of everything in Germany today. The fine flat, he says, costs only £5 a month and is set in lovely woodland amongst silver birches and fir trees, which have been carefully preserved by the builder. These flats have central heating and every labour-saving device." He goes on to say, and I find this absolutely fascinating, because as we know, the Nazis, Hitler had taken over in 1933 in Germany, And this is 1937, so well inside the 12 years that Hitler ruled Germany. Berlin was the hotbed, of course, of the Nazi Party, the capital of Nazism. And he says in his article that walking in the Berlin streets, the Englishmen were intrigued by the absence of makeup on the faces of German women. Lipstick is unpopular in Germany, apparently, and the people seem to be able to get on without it. They are well-dressed, happy and very kind, says Mr. Baldwin. And he said that the Germans had made greater progress as far as he could see. And he said that England could be unrivalled in certain aspects. Dr. Liebig and Mr. Baldwin were walking past a big group of solid metal statues. And the German was asked by his guests whether they were likely to be any need for the melting down of such statues in view of the present metal shortage. The German reply was emphatic. He said, "We were not obliged to use them in 1914, so we certainly shall not be doing it now." I wonder whether they did use it, of course, when the Second World War broke out, whether those metal statues were turned into Panzer and Tiger tanks. Now, it says, one of the people that Mr. Baldwin met was a German lady friend, his wife, and he had known in London before the war. And she wrote asking if she could see him when he came over to Germany. And she even enclosed a piece of material matching the dress she would be wearing at the station so he'd recognise her. Mr. Baldwin carried many messages of greetings. He had greetings from a Leamington branch of the British Legion. Another English soldier who fought in the Boom Ravine also sent greetings. And he also conveyed greetings from the Leamington PSA. And the article finishes by saying that Dr. Liebig hopes that he'll be able to visit Mr. Baldwin in 1940. He will be unable to come over to England before then because he's engaged on business. And of course, by 1940, the two nations were at war again. And I wonder what became of Dr. Liebig in the Second World War. I've also found another heartwarming story about a Loughborough man, Loughborough in Leicestershire. And it goes on to say that he returned the watch of a German soldier to his family 20 years after the war. He said the watch had been taken from a soldier from the Brandenburg Regiment in Boom Ravine at Miremont on that day, the 17th of February 1917. And when he opened the case that the watch was in, he found the name of the owner and the village, which was called Lessem, which is near Bremen. And it says that the watch changed hands in this country, and the present owner felt that he couldn't conscientiously possess it for any longer, and he asked a friend whether they would help him try and find the owner's family whilst they're on tour of Germany in the summer. So when they went to Germany, Mr. Bramley took the watch to a friend of his in Magdeburg, and with the assistance of the press there, they found that the dead soldier's mother was still living in the same village. Now, the German soldier that we're talking about was reported missing. He hadn't officially been declared dead even 20 years later, and the mother of the soldier was herself a widow, and she'd never known, she didn't have any closure, she didn't know what had happened to her son. She always thought that he was missing, she knew he was missing, of course, but like they all did when these soldiers were missing, until the memorials to the missing were built, she held on to that hope that, like so many others perhaps in the area, that he would return to her. But knowing that her son's watch had been found on his body, she knew now she'd got that closure. She knew that he was dead. And she must have been very shocked when they turned up with that watch. And she asked for full details about the place and the circumstances of her son's death. Now, when we're talking about the men from all nations that died in the First World War and other conflicts, so many of them were so young, and so many of them had studied so hard at school, and they had their whole lives ahead of them, and I suppose they saw joining the army as just a temporary glitch, really, in their life plans, because so many of them had got plans to move into banking or into the arts or into any sort of profession, really, where they could make their mark on the world, and of course they never did because their lives were cut down. And that is very much the case when we look at one of those men that was serving as a junior officer in the 6th Northamptons. And his name was Denzil Mitford Harris Smith, and he'd been born at Filey in Yorkshire in 1894. He was educated at Bedford School and he was head of the school, and he received a prize from Lord Roberts because he was the best all-round boy in the school. And later on, he entered Queen's College at Cambridge, and he was going to take holy orders. But on the 16th of September 1914, so just a few weeks into the war, he joined the 19th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers, but he was soon granted, just in the December of 1914, a commission into the North Ants. He joined the 6th Battalion of the North Ants in France on the 17th of December 1915, and he was one of those men at Trones Wood that was involved in the taking of the wood near Guillemont on the 14th of July 1916, and in fact, within his company, A Company, he was the only officer that was unwounded. And in fact, the battalion went in with 17 officers that day. Only two were unwounded, of course, of which he was one. But then we come to the Battle of Boom Ravine. And we know that Denzil was mortally wounded by shell fire. They think it was probably a trench mortar that was fired from the tongue position in Boom Ravine. He was removed from the battle by stretcher bearers from the battalion, and he received attention in the trenches from his regimental doctor, and he was evacuated from the trenches by the 54th Field Ambulance, the Royal Army Medical Corps. But that was the end of his journey because he died of his wounds. And he's one of those 48 soldiers from the 6th North Ants that's buried in Regina Trench Military Cemetery. His commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Reginald Turner, wrote this of Harris Smith. He said, "I cannot speak too highly of your son's coolness and gallantry in action, and of the affection with which men regarded him. He'd been through two big actions with distinction. He died doing his duty and leading his men as he would have wished." There are more tributes paid to this young man. He did splendidly in the battle, getting forward with his platoon. He was a great sportsman and a true English gentleman. This was a Major Podmore that had written this. He said, "He was a fine soldier, and I cannot speak too highly of his coolness and gallantry in action, and of the affection with which the men regarded him." The battalion chaplain says, "I cannot say what a loss he is to us." Now, on the 5th of April 1917, so just a few weeks after the battle, a private Wyman wrote to the Northampton Independent, and he said this: "Seeing about the late Denzil Harris Smith's death in your paper last week, I thought it would be of interest to know that of the four that fetched him out of the barrage, two of us, Private Wyman and Sylvester of D Company, 6th North Ants, are still here. But I'm sorry to say that the others are killed. We got him to our regimental doctor. After that, four more took him to the RAMC station. We had to carry him about 700 yards to safety. And we've also written to the late Lieutenant Smith's family." So he was an officer. But what about the other ranks, the privates? Private Arthur Mayhew, Northamptonshire Regiment. He was the youngest son of Mr. and Mrs. A. Mayhew from Wellingborough, killed in action on the 17th. And the local newspaper states this: "The sad news is conveyed to his parents by the lieutenant of the platoon in which Private Mayhew was serving. And the letter, which also states that death was instantaneous, also speaks of the loss both officers and men feel at the death of one who was liked so much by all." It goes on to say that Mayhew was one of the best known young men in Wellingborough because he held the position as assistant rate collector, working for the council, so he was collecting rates. He entered Mr. Cowper's office as a lad, and when Mr. Cowper gave up the post in the early part of 1916, Mayhew remained for a short period with Mr. Archer, who was the new collector. Besides being a most capable and conscientious official, earning the respect of both employer and townspeople, he had a great personal popularity despite a naturally retiring disposition. For long a member of the Wesleyan Church, he was chiefly connected with the Young People's Meeting, in the orchestral band of which he was a player, the violin being his favourite instrument. He was in his 23rd year. He joined up in May last year and went out to France in August. And Mayhew, like 60 others, has no known grave, and he's remembered on the Teat Vale Memorial. So Maybe he's in the Regina Trench Cemetery under an unknown headstone, or maybe he's still lying where he died. Another one who died that day was Private Charles Baker from Gladstone Terrace in Northampton. He was 32 years old. Now, he was a regular soldier. He'd been with the colours for 13 years and had served for a long time in India. And Mr. and Mrs. Baker, the article says, had got four sons in the army and three son-in-laws, a grandson, a brother-in-law and six nephews also serving. And of those, four have been killed and eight wounded. So this is only by 1917 that family had suffered no end. We've got another officer here, a second lieutenant, P.H. Higham, Military Cross. And he was the youngest son of Mr. and Mrs. Higham from Melton Mowbray, and the grandson of John Denny, who was a JP in Silverstone. He was educated at Melton Mowbray British School, and he gained a county council scholarship, which took him to a school in Leicester, where he distinguished himself. He joined the Northants Yeomanry in October 1914, at which time he was assistant master at Eaglehurst College in Northampton. And he went to France in the early summer of 1915. He gained a commission in April 1916, and he was awarded the Military Cross for conspicuous gallantry in action. Now, he was accompanied by a non-commissioned officer and one man. He carried out a difficult and dangerous reconnaissance and obtained most valuable information. And on another occasion, he rendered valuable services whilst in charge of a carrying party. He was personally decorated with the ribbon of the Military Cross by Sir Ivor Max in January, and he was killed on the 17th of February, leading an attack. And a memorial service was held at the Freeree Congregational Church on Sunday, and it was conducted by the Reverend C.T. Lander, who paid an eloquent tribute to the heroism and sacrifice of this fallen officer. And again, he has no known grave, and he's remembered on the Teepvale Memorial. What we know about him, a major wrote to his family, like so many of them, he says he was killed instantaneously while gallantly leading his men in the attack. I've never known a young officer who combined the highest sense of duty and the greatest personal bravery and qualities of leadership with a more complete modesty and self-effacement. He was an ideal leader of men, and the men with whom he was especially associated lately, scouts and snipers, loved him and would follow him anywhere. I'm sure they would. It just shows the bond that was created by these men when they were experiencing the worst experience that I suppose any human being could expect to have to put up with in their lives. There was another sportsman, this time a private, Chas Charlie H. Pearson. And the local newspaper were informed that he was killed in action on the 17th, and they've been unsuccessful in obtaining any details, and they never did. He's one that's on Teepvale. 32 years of age. Prior to enlisting, he was in Luton for 4 years, and he worked for Messrs. Blundell's in the capacity of salesman and window dresser in their drapery department. His services were highly valued. He was a friend to all, and he was known to his mates as Tony. And in the sporting circles of the town especially, he was excellent at both cricket and football. And the Wednesday Hotspurs had him as a valuable member. One of his best chums in the circle, Horace Dunham, was killed at the front in 1916. It says that Private Pearson lodged with Mrs. Daly of Grove Road all the time he was in Luton. And he was one of 30 employees from Blundell Brothers who joined up. He was a Derby recruit, and he was called to the colours about a year ago. After 16 weeks training with the Bedfords, he went to France, transferred to the Northants. His friends will remember that in November last he was missing, and his chums believe him dead then. But later it was discovered that he had gone from his regiment to take charge of prisoners. He returned to his chums later and was an officer's servant. And of course, his death is mourned by all who knew him. So the reason why I chose just those few stories was to really emphasise the point that regardless of the background of these men, some had come from privileged backgrounds where their parents had made money in industry, or whether they came from the back streets of Northampton or any other town, they were all men that had got hopes and aspirations for the future. Mostly young men, some a bit old. I think one there we said was 32 years old. but they were all hoping to return from the trenches and pick up their lives and continue with their plans, just in the same way that I did when I was young and that you did listening to this podcast. And to me, that's why it's so, so important that we tell not necessarily the story of the Battle of Boom Ravine, but the story of the men that were there and the story of the men that didn't come back and didn't pick up those lives that they hoped to. And as with any failed battle, there were repercussions. And the very next day, the 5th Army Commander, General Gough, he called for an immediate inquiry to examine the reasons why the attack had failed. And he put out this order. He said, "The Army Commander wishes you, without delay, to assemble a committee of experienced officers to investigate the reasons for our troops in the attack of the 17th, not having reached their second and third objectives. He says the lessons to be learned from the fighting are to be thoroughly investigated, and recommendations as to how any shortcomings in the working out of the plan for yesterday's attack can be avoided in future. He wishes special inquiries to be made as to how it was that the enemy's machine guns on the right flank were not kept out of action by our artillery barrage." Whereas, of course, as we now know all these years later, one of the main reasons why the attack failed was because the weather changed. But also, as we mentioned a couple of times in the last hour or so, we did have deserters that gave the game away to the enemy on the other side of No Man's Land. And on the same day, another order went out to the 2nd Division, not the 18th that the North Ants were in, but the 2nd Division. It says that the Army Commander wishes you to assemble without delay a court of inquiry to investigate the truth of the statements of German prisoners to the effect that a deserter or deserters from our troops went over to the enemy in the early hours of the morning of the 17th in the vicinity of the East Miramont Road. Now, in the archives, there are no documents that tells us what the outcome of those inquiries were, if indeed those inquiries were carried out. So I hope you enjoyed those tales from the battlefields. It really does bring it home to me when I research these stories about these men that went off to the Western Front, some that came back and some that didn't, how they were just, as so many people have said, ordinary men doing incredible things on the Western Front. And I always wonder about these men that came back. You know, we often forget about those, but what happened to the rest of their lives? You know, they lived with it all of their lives, 60, 70 years maybe, thinking about the lads that they left behind and living in some cases with physical wounds and no doubt the mental wounds forevermore. Boom Ravine, not often talked about, but I hope we've done it justice this week. So once again, thanks very much for tuning in. And we've got some podcasts coming up in the next couple of weeks. The next one in a week or 10 days, we've got a special guest on, a man called Jeremy Gordon Smith. And he's written a book called Photograph in the Fallen, a war graves photographer on the Western Front, 1915 to 1919. And he's talking about his great uncle, who was called Ivan Bawtry. And he left behind when he died an archives that tell the story of his work as a photographer with the graves registration units on the Western Front for those 4 years, mostly around Ypres, but he also went down to the Somme. And we look at what he found when he was photographing the original headstones of those soldiers that fell on the Western Front, and how that wasn't a safe job. It's a fascinating story, so please tune in for that. And then after that, I'll be doing my first tour of the year to the Western Front. I won't be guiding. I'll be going with a selection of guides. So I think there's 5 or 6 of us that are going over really for a jolly on the Western Front. But while we're there, we're going to be recording some stories and looking at the ground, and we'll be turning those into a podcast as well. So tune in for that. That'll be something different. And all it leaves me to do is to thank you once again for tuning in to my podcast. Keep leaving the reviews on Spotify and Apple. That really does help. And as usual, I'd like to pay tribute to all those men, wherever they were from, that fought in the Boom Ravine on the 17th of February 1917. And we do that, of course, by playing The Last Post.